Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. 47 years ago this month, President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated by certain leaders of the U.S. national security state, so-called. The assassination was blamed on a single lowlife type, Lee Harvey Oswald, who I believe was indeed part of the plot. Oswald didn't understand that his real role in the plot was Fall Guy. To understand the assassination, we have to understand some history. When Kennedy was elected president in 1960, the U.S.'s so-called enemies were the Soviet Union, that's Russia plus several small republics, the Soviet Union and its economic system, communism. The Soviet Union had a client state in nearby Cuba, nearby to us, that is. The U.S. national security state, that is, the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies, really, really wanted to go to war with the Soviet Union because we would win and then be undisputed hegemon of the world. As we are today, by the way. The CIA-sponsored invasion of Cuba in 1961 was part of this strategy, the Bay of Pigs invasion. Kennedy initially authorized it, but then pulled the rug out from under the warmongers by refusing to send in the Marines to support the doomed invaders. At this point, Kennedy and the CIA started hating each other. A much bigger crisis occurred in October 1962 when the CIA discovered a Russian nuclear missile base in Cuba. The military and the CIA were howling to bomb Cuba to take out the missile base before the missiles could be armed with their nuclear warheads. Years later, we discovered that the missiles already were armed with nuclear warheads. To make a long story short, Kennedy and the enemy leader, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, allied, and at great risks to themselves, barely managed to hold off the dogs of war on both sides. We are alive today because of Kennedy and Khrushchev. Kennedy understood how close the world had come to nuclear annihilation, and this understanding changed him. Afterwards, on June 10, 2003, Kennedy took an extremely bold step. In his commencement address at American University, Kennedy basically called for an end to the so-called Cold War with the Soviet Union. He declared universal disarmament a goal of the United States. He announced a large unilateral step in this direction, the immediate halting of all U.S. above-ground testing of nuclear weapons. And he announced that the U.S. and the Soviet Union would begin negotiating a treaty to ban testing of all nuclear weapons. Not only that, he concluded the treaty 3 weeks later, rallied public support for it, and got it ratified by the Senate. The Cuban Missile Crisis converted Kennedy from a militaristic cold warrior to the Western Hemisphere's strongest proponent of peace and disarmament. That's why he was killed. It's a stunning story and would be an inspiring one if Americans had ever heard the story, which most of us haven't. This weekend next, we'll recycle two installments we did on the subject in 2008. A few of the references are dated. My contrasts of Kennedy with G.W. Bush, who was president when the show was made. Just mentally substitute Obama for Bush, and everything still applies. Here we go. Today, in the first of a two-part series, we'll hear President John F. Kennedy delivering the first half of his greatest speech ever on June 10, 1963. This is a commencement address he gave at the American University in Washington, D.C. I think that Kennedy knew that after making this speech, he was a dead man. He also knew that he and Khrushchev had just very narrowly averted World War III, to the disappointment of the national security state on both sides. I think Kennedy realized that this magnificent speech had to be given, and he had to give it. I'll return at the end of the program. Until then, we'll hear two voices, those of John F. Kennedy and of scholar and writer Jim Douglas, author of the new book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. The wisdom, the humanity, the logic and organization, the depth of morality of Kennedy's talk rebukes the toxic waste spewed forth from the mouths of our national misleaders for at least the past three decades. As you listen to Kennedy emphasizing the common bonds and common humanity shared by Americans and the people of their so-called enemy, then the Soviet Union, give a passing thought to our little cowboy and his eternal war against evildoers and his self-defined enemies, the Axis of Evil. One quick note, when you hear a sound that sounds like a string being plucked, yes, not unlike that, that's an indication that I have removed some words from Kennedy's speech. Otherwise, you're hearing it exactly as delivered. Here's Jim Douglas.
Kennedy and Khrushchev, they had been terrified by the position they had placed themselves in the world. And they saw from this new relationship that they had, underlying which was their secret correspondence, that they could move in a direction of a peaceful world that would be of great benefit to both their countries and to the forces on both sides of the Cold War. And they had to do that by concrete steps, and the first one was to be a nuclear test ban. And Norman Cousins, a remarkable man, the editor of the Saturday Review, who was going as was a go-between on the ground between Kennedy and Khrushchev, taking secret messages back and forth between them, Cousins said to Kennedy in the spring, "You've got to make a great speech for peace." He challenged JFK. And JFK accepted the challenge, and he accepted Khrushchev's challenge that it was up to him to take a step now. Khrushchev had taken the first step in the missile crisis. He'd pulled back his missiles publicly at a point that placed a lot of pressure on him. And so Kennedy, in his American University address, gave what Khrushchev called the greatest speech any American president has done since Roosevelt.
"There are few earthly things more beautiful than a university," wrote John Masefield in his tribute to English universities, and his words are equally true today. He did not refer to towers or to campuses. He admired the splendid beauty of a university because it was, he said, a place where those who hate ignorance may strive to know, where those who perceive truth may strive to make others see. "I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived, and that is the most important topic on earth, peace. What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war, not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children, not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women, not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense in an age where a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and to generations yet unborn. Today, the expenditure of billions of dollars every year on weapons acquired for the purpose of making sure we never need them is essential to the keeping of peace. But surely the acquisition of such idle stockpiles, which can only destroy and never create, is not the only, much less the most efficient, means of assuring peace. I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task. And every graduate of this school, every thoughtful citizen who despairs of war and wishes to bring peace, should begin by looking inward, by examining his own attitude towards the possibilities of peace, towards the Soviet Union, towards the course of the Cold War, and towards freedom and peace here at home. Let us focus instead on a more practical, more attainable peace, based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions, on a series of concrete actions and effective agreements which are in the interests of all concerned. There is no single simple key to this peace, no grand or magic formula to be adopted by one or two powers. Genuine peace must be the product of many nations, the sum of many acts. It must be dynamic, not static, changing to meet the challenge of each new generation. For peace is a process, a way of solving problems. With such a peace, there will still be quarrels and conflicting interests, as there are within families and nations. World peace, like community peace, does not require that each man love his neighbor. It requires only that they live together in mutual tolerance, submitting their disputes to a just and peaceful settlement. And history teaches us that enmities between nations, as between individuals, do not last forever. However fixed our likes and dislikes may seem, the tide of time and events will often bring surprising changes in the relations between nations and neighbors. So let us persevere. Peace need not be impractical, and war need not be inevitable. By defining our goal more clearly, by making it seem more manageable and less remote, we can help all people to see it, to draw hope from it, and to move irresistibly towards it. And second, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Soviet Union. It is discouraging to think that their leaders may actually believe what their propagandists write. It is discouraging to read a recent authoritative Soviet text on military strategy and find on page after page wholly baseless and incredible claims, such as the allegation that American imperialist circles are preparing to unleash different types of war, that there is a very real threat of a preventative war being unleashed by American imperialists against the Soviet Union, and that the political aims, and I quote, of the American imperialists are to enslave economically and politically the European and other capitalist countries and to achieve world domination by means of aggressive war, unquote. Truly, as it was written long ago, the wicked flee when no man pursueth. Yet it is sad to read these Soviet statements to realize the extent of the gulf between us. But it is also a warning to the American people not to fall into the same trap as the Soviets, not to see only a distorted and desperate view of the other side, not to see conflict as inevitable, accommodation as impossible, and communication as nothing more than an exchange of threats. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits the peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war. Almost unique, among the major world powers, we have never been at war with each other. And no nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War. At least 20 million lost their lives. Countless millions of homes and families were burned or sacked. A third of the nation's territory, including two-thirds of its industrial base, was turned into a wasteland, a loss equivalent to the destruction of this country east of Chicago. Today, should total war ever break out again, no matter how, our two countries will be the primary target. It is an ironic but accurate fact that the two strongest powers are the two in the most danger of devastation. All we have built, all we have worked for, would be destroyed in the first 24 hours. And even in the Cold War, which brings burdens and dangers to so many countries, including this nation's closest allies, our two countries bear the heaviest burdens. For we are both devoting massive sums of money to weapons that could be better devoted to combat ignorance, poverty, and disease. We are both caught up in a vicious and dangerous cycle, with suspicion on one side breeding suspicion on the other, and new weapons begetting counterweapons. In short, both the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies, have a mutually deep interest in a just and genuine peace and in halting the arms race. Agreements to this end are in the interests of the Soviet Union as well as ours. And even the most hostile nations can be relied upon to accept and keep those treaty obligations, and only those treaty obligations, which are in their own interest. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
He reached out to the enemy by describing the pain and the suffering and the death of Soviet people during World War II. He described a kind of destruction and just overwhelming devastation. And then he said, this will be nothing compared to what will happen if there is a nuclear exchange between their country and our country.
But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. And no nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War.
Then he said, this speech is devoted to peace. And what kind of peace do I mean?
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war.
Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. And by that reference, he was coming out foursquare against the military-industrial complex. A Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war is precisely what Eisenhower was talking about in the phrase military-industrial complex, and what created enormous profits for the forces in the United States that were most compelling us toward war.
Georgie Porgie put in a pie in his playpen in the White House of Lies. Sat around with all of his friends, told them all on him to depend. Oil is what all of us need. The American habit will feed. There's a place that we're gonna attack for their oil and for Daddy Iraq. and lies about what it was for. Now your baby is out in Iraq. Do you know if they're coming back?
And then Kennedy said, I, from this point on, will not test a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere unless somebody else does. It was a unilateral initiative. He said, we want to go to Moscow. Of course, that's the capital of the other side, the Soviet Union. And he said, we want to obtain a test ban treaty. And Khrushchev and he did it in 6 weeks. In the 6 weeks after that speech, Kennedy and Khrushchev negotiated the limited test ban treaty, the first step in ending the Cold War. And they did so in what was, from the standpoint of Kennedy, an end run around his military advisors. He didn't consult any of them. He said, we're going ahead. We've got to do this. It has to be done. When his representative, Averill Harriman, went to Moscow and was there talking with the Soviet negotiators, every time any kind of particular question on the wording of the treaty came up, Averill Harriman would run to a phone and he'd make a phone call to Washington. The Soviets said, well, who are you talking to? He said, John Kennedy. Kennedy personally negotiated that entire treaty from the White House without his military advisors being involved. And, of course, they thought this was, from their standpoint, a surrender from an advantage that the U.S. needed to have by further testing. And then from that point on, it was one thing after another. Then Kennedy got the treaty by an enormous act of turnaround on the part of the American public through the U.S. Senate, and he gained the Senate's approval of the treaty. And he did that by working with the U.S. peace movement. Norman Cousins was the chairperson of SANE, Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, and Cousins organized peace activists and editors and people working at women's magazines especially to just engage in a terrific public education campaign in August and September, and it turned public opinion around. It was very deeply opposed to the test ban, and Kennedy, by his personal appeal over radio and TV and all these other folk he was working with and peace activists, got the Senate to pass it. And then Kennedy began secret negotiations with Fidel Castro, considered even more the devil from the standpoint of the overriding theology of absolute good versus absolute evil that we were following in the Cold War, just as we follow it today in the so-called War on Terror. He began to open up to Cuba, and he had an assistant to Adlai Stevenson communicating directly to Castro to work out meetings so that the U.S. representative, William Atwood, the assistant to Stevenson, and Castro could begin to move forward on normalizing relationship between U.S. and Cuba, something that hasn't happened to this day.
Kennedy may have signed his own death warrant in early 1961 when he let the CIA-sponsored Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba fail, rather than bomb Havana and send in the Marines to avoid the ignominy of a failed invasion. The CIA knew the invasion would fail. Their ultimate goal, and the Pentagon's goal, was to force Kennedy into attacking the Soviet Union. Kennedy did not fall for the ruse. He chose humiliation over World War III. Maybe Kennedy signed his death warrant right afterwards, when he fired CIA head Allen Dulles. Or maybe when he refused to commit ground troops to the war in Vietnam. Or in October 1962, when he refused to bomb Cuba and or Russia after Soviet missile bases were discovered in Cuba. In this decision, he made enemies of the rest of the CIA, the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff, and some of his own cabinet. Instead, at great personal risk to themselves, President Kennedy and Chairman Khrushchev defused the crisis through diplomacy and compromise. A year later, neither was in office. Or maybe Kennedy signed his death warrant when he initiated secret negotiations with Castro on normalizing relations. Or whenever Kennedy signed his death warrant, it was notarized, sealed, and delivered on June 10, 1963. At the commencement address, not only did he announce a unilateral halt to atmospheric testing, he announced he would be off to Moscow to negotiate a nuclear test ban treaty. And as we shall hear next week, he announced that a nuclear test ban was only the first step in a series of many steps towards the ultimate goal of complete universal disarmament. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. Thanks for listening. For the Kennedy speech, our thanks to the Internet Archive. For my excerpts from a long interview with Jim Douglas, many thanks yet again to Mike McCormick and Mind Over Matters. Until next time, here's wishing you a good week. Illa get to my non-carborundum. Try to speak the truth and keep the faith.
Brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. Imagine. Thank you very much. Peace. Strive for peace. Let's come together.
One, two, three, four.
Imagine. All I'm saying is give peace a chance. Peace. A chance.
All of us want peace.